Cast not your pearls before swine is one of those wonderfully famous quotations from the Bible that has lent itself to any number of jokes. One of the my favorite in this was two extremely competitive New York socialites whose names I wouldn't recognize even if I could remember them. And on the New York social scene, this is whether it actually happened or not, this is supposedly happened. They both were entering some party or restaurant, and they were always in competition with each other, and they came to the door at exactly the same moment, and it became an impasse as to who got to go in first. And one woman instantly stepped back, and she said, "Age before beauty," like this. And the other woman said, "Pearls before swine," and walked right in. It, of course, has nothing to do with our topic today. But certain phrases of Jesus really have stuck through the ages, and this is definitely one of them. But there's something really profoundly important here on levels much deeper than just humor. Or as Swami, I love the way he puts it, he said, in those days, debate took place with a certain hearty give and take, is how he put it, when Jesus characterized those who were not ready to hear as swine. It's really not a very courteous way to speak of people who are less evolved than you are. So there had to have been this dynamic energy happening at the time. But what really is being talked about here is interesting. It's the real question of how do you help people? Because there's always this fine line that we all get into between the energy and enthusiasm or the clarity of mind or the deep insight that we might have into the world around us and this overwhelming enthusiasm that wants to share it, but then the flow of that energy itself and the pleasure of doing that sometimes becomes more important to us than the actual effect that we're going to have. And so sometimes people, in the name of helping others, are really just indulging their own cleverness, their own pleasure in being in the limelight, the opportunity to show off how much they know, or more nefarious motives, the power to have it over someone, be smarter than they are, to best them in debate. Many times when I stand up here, you always hear me speak about Swami Kriyananda. He's the American man who is the founder of all of Ananda. He was a direct disciple of Yogananda, the master whose picture is on the wall behind us. But it is through Kriyananda that we have understood Yogananda's teachings. My own experience of Kriyananda has been extremely blessed. I can't really put words on what a blessing it is. I'll just use small words and imply much more. And I've had the opportunity to observe him in action in the context of the Ananda communities, in the context of the whole world, really both written and spoken, in person, in all different ways, interacting with people for now 40 years, which is a pretty long time. I've also been able to watch him handle me, you know, which is always a thing in itself. When I was observing once my emotional reactions to things, this is not about Swami, this is about my husband, I said to David once, "How much time do you spend just kind of like working around my emotional reactions?" And in his marvelously diplomatic way, he said, "You really don't want to know." Which was very good. He's been listening to Swamiji too. But with Swami Kriyananda, I've been able to see. First, I was on the unconscious receiving end. And then over time, as I became more aware, I was able both to look back on how he handled me and observe how he handled others. I mean, astonishing degrees of consideration, but let me not go too far that direction at the moment. But the main thing that I gradually began to understand about Swamiji was, number one, he had perfect insight into the people around him. In fact, jokingly recently, we were talking about, I was going to make a book of his one-liners. He can sort of summarize situations and people in just a few words more than anyone I know, lovingly, but just absolutely apt, describe what people are like. One man once came and demanded an explanation for why Swamiji had treated a certain other devotee in a certain way. I love Swami's response. He said, "To explain to you why I responded to him in that way would be to tell you more about that other man than you have any right to know." Just a perfect answer, wasn't it? Which is, I know what I'm doing, and I'm not going to bring you into it. You're not mature enough for it. Swamiji rarely spoke as insultingly as that. That was a very unusual moment, but the circumstances required it. And another woman, this is not exactly kind, but it was funny. This woman was very insecure, and a friend, no, I'm not going to tell you that. That's not kind. I shouldn't say it. But what I observed with Swamiji is he has perfect insight into people, but he has nothing at stake except their welfare. He doesn't even have his own convenience at stake, which is an extremely important thing. Swamiji will literally sacrifice his own convenience to the end point, as long as there's no principle involved. If there's a principle involved, he suddenly becomes rock hard. But if it's just everybody else wants to go there and he would prefer not to, he'll just go there. Everybody else wants to have this thing happen and he doesn't want it, he'll just do it, if it's just a matter of opinion. But all he ever really wants is the well-being of the people around him. And added to that is this extraordinary sensitivity to how much truth is helpful. When Swamiji wrote a little essay once called What is Truth? And one of the points of it was, very simply, he said, truth is always kind. That doesn't mean truth is always gentle. But truth is always kind. It's always kind in the sense that it is never hurtful. Even if people get their feelings hurt sometimes by hearing the truth, there's always a kindness behind it. And if people, in the name of truth, do things that are deliberately and consciously hurtful to others, this is not necessarily going to lift. His concern is always and only that what we hear gives us more energy to go forward in the end. I mean, naturally, sometimes we have to hear that we haven't really lived up to the standard that we wanted to live up to. Swamiji fired me from a job once. No, he fired me more than once. But one of the times that I was fired from a job, I was so incompetent and I was struggling so hard, and it was such a nightmare for me and for him. So finally he just switched my job with someone else's. You know, he did it sort of gracefully, but I was fired, and I was bright enough to know that I'd been fired and honest enough to be happy that I was fired. But I said to him, I know that there's something you have to tell me that's going to be a little hard for me to hear, but it was Friday. I said, why don't you tell me on Monday? And then over the weekend, I can just enjoy the fact that I have gotten out of this horrible position. So for 3 days, I just enjoyed the fact that I was not going to have to do it anymore. And then on Monday, I heard the hard truth and had to be a little, you know, I had to fight my way back. But he's a master at knowing just how much a person can take, how much medicine will strengthen you, and then how much medicine will just push you so far down that you're not going to be able to come back again. Now, what this requires, above all things, beyond even insight into people, is that we have to have nothing at stake. How many times do we say things to people in the name of helping them that really have nothing to do with helping them? It's just that we can't stand it anymore. Isn't that the truth? And so you burst out something that may be absolutely accurate, but there's no genuine selfless desire to serve. There's just, I've got to get this off my chest. Now, if we're going to really have a long class on how to work with people, we talk about how these things balance. But even and especially and above all, here we are talking about this principle of giving spiritual truth. And there's a certain interpretation of Jesus' teachings which says that we have an obligation to go out and tell people about this, because otherwise they're going to be damned and go to hell, and we must try to convert them. Now, to just give the good news, and I've often heard this expressed by missionaries before, is I just have to tell them. Whether they accept it or not is not my issue. Now that I've told them, they have the chance, and then their fate is in their own hands. And, you know, everybody's following their own path, and let's just let that flow as however it flows. But in our everyday experiences with people, and especially when it comes to spiritual matters, we have to not ask, what do I know? We have to look at someone and ask, what are they trying to learn? And above all, what are they able to learn? If I were going to describe Swami Kriyananda's genius as a leader in just a simple phrase like he can do, he has a genius for knowing what next step you can actually take. Now think about that. Because all of us, we have to move forward a step at a time. We flatter ourselves that we're going to be able to make these sudden shifts, and oftentimes we go into situations where great emotional catharsis happens and we have this illusion that some great change has taken place. But unfortunately, usually when it's now I've finally learned it, now I've overcome it, this has bothered me my whole life, now I'm free. Usually, as Swamiji says, emotional realities like that grow misty very quickly. And then you can remember that something happened, but you can't quite remember what it was. And you can't quite find that feeling again. Genuine spiritual change often comes more like a thief in the night. And we just gradually find that over the course of months or years, just the whole inner, our whole inner reality has rearranged itself. And negative inclinations that we had, negative feelings that we had, they've just faded away. We don't even know where they've gone. Deeply speaking, it's the vrittis in the spine that have gradually been resolved, especially by Kriya Yoga. We've just, those knots of misunderstanding have been dissolved by the clear light of wisdom. But the biggest challenge in life is really not to make these massive shifts. The biggest challenge in life is just every day, on an everyday basis, just to keep moving forward. Just to keep moving forward. That's why we urge people so much, you know, go where you have satsang. Keep reading inspiring things. Put yourself in the company of uplifting energy. Because otherwise, slowly by slowly, we just move away from it. And we don't even remember why. That's why discipline and routine and rhythm in a spiritual life. And when we take Kriya Yoga, we promise to practice it faithfully and regularly as it is taught to us. And in a very solemn ceremony, we take that vow and receive the blessing. And it's not as if every person there is going to actually live up to that, because God knows. I love the phrase faithfully and regularly. Often, sometimes people will come to me somewhat shamefaced and tell me that they're meditation, they don't necessarily meditate every morning and every night, and they wanted to, but they don't. I said, well, do you meditate regularly? And they'll say, well, I mean, have you given up meditating? Have you stopped thinking of yourself as a meditator? If you meditate faithfully, which is to meditate the way you were taught with devotion, and regularly, even if that regularly is only once a week, it's still regular, isn't it? You know, or even if it's only once a month, it's still regular, isn't it? Now, I'm not trying to look for loopholes. You know, I'm not trying to hold up the contract to God like a lawyer and say, well, you see, I still did it, you know. What does this word actually mean? As, shall, you know, we can argue about these words. But Master Yogananda tells us, and Swamiji has exemplified, that magnetism is everything. We don't really realize that, but the quality of our energy creates a quality of magnetism. The quality of our energy is based on our attitudes, our thoughts, our self-perceptions, the degree to which our emotions and our fears run away from us. I mean, just think about it. When we become anxious and nervous, we become sad and depressed, any of those things, there's a whole cascading series of events that happens, isn't it? I feel too depressed. I just can't get up in the morning. I knew I should have done it, but I just didn't feel like it because I'm sad. I have such low energy, or I was too afraid, or I was too angry, all these different things. Once you start an attitude, then action follows and energy follows, and then our magnetism begins to reflect that. And our magnetism is everything, because this whole universe, even though it looks like a fixed reality, it's just patterns of energy playing against each other. And those energy patterns are completely responsive to the kind of magnetism we're putting out. And even the thoughts that we think are a reflection of the magnetism we're putting out. Because their thoughts in are universal in the universe. That's how Yogananda describes it. Our thoughts aren't individual. They exist as planes of consciousness. And we receive whatever thoughts we are attracting to ourselves. And so, isn't it so that once you get depressed, you have lots of, you think of all the reasons why you should be depressed. And it's like, now that I'm sad, and now that I really recognize what a hopeless person I am, I appreciate that you, who've lived with me faithfully all these years, never really loved me. You know, isn't it so? And then he says, or she says, yes, I have. No, I see it. You're being nice even now. I mean, how many arguments have you had like that? Right? where you just start with a certain orientation and everything supports it. And then for whatever reason, when you come out of it, you can look at the same circumstances and it all looks different because our magnetism is literally attracting from the universe different thoughts. So everything is about the magnetism that we put out. And our magnetism is dependent on what attitudes we have toward life, what consciousness we have. Now, so many people think that the way to help others is, I need to tell you what's wrong with you. You need really to hear this. You must face this fact. And if we're clever, we can notice things and we can say it. And we sit people down and do what Swamiji told me not to do anymore. He said, Asha, people don't want to know. Just like that. They're not really interested. He didn't finish the phrase, but I heard it in how smart you are. You know, that's basically your issue, not theirs. What people want is the courage, the comfort, and the encouragement, the support to be able to go forward. I've rarely met anyone who didn't know what they ought to do. Every once in a while you meet somebody who really actually doesn't know what they ought to do. And most of the art of counseling, at least I've found, is just to listen and then point out to people what they already know. If you're pointing out to something that they've never thought about before, they're not going to understand it anyway. But very often people are a little confused about what they know. But you have to point out what people already know. Because it's as we say in our writing today, if it doesn't resonate inwardly, it's not going to be true for them. So what we're working with in the art of helping people is not the cleverness of how we can explain it, but the sensitivity of knowing when we should say it. And I've seen Swamiji quite literally. This was one amazing case where there was this one man in our community, and you know, we're a close family, and everybody has their unique characteristics, which we shall call them that in a charming manner. Everybody is singing their own particular song that God has given them, and the songs don't always mesh. Sometimes the chords are really not the same. So we have friends, dear friends and guru bhais in our community, some who drive each other crazy. And there was this one gentleman, dear, absolutely as dear as he could be, but he was a more troublesome sort. And even Swamiji was becoming just a little bit aware of his nature. Usually Swamiji is just, he sees the positive. He's not blind to it, but he doesn't even bother to see anything else. And he said, really, I think I must take him in hand. I really need to speak to him. Someone like me was just like, yes, let's go. And so I began to wait. I began to wait for the opportunities. And this man kept acting out his unique nature. And he would act it out in Swami's company, and I would just wait for Swami's to follow through. 10 years went by. 10 years. And then the moment was right. Swami spoke. And it wasn't as if he enjoyed in between what was happening, but it was just like his real and only interest was in helping that man. He could have tried to protect everyone else from their annoyance. He could have expressed his own annoyance. But in the end, what he really wanted to do was help that man. And so he just waited until he could. You know, we have lots of very confused motivations when we step into giving people advice. The whole subject today is even telling them about the spiritual path. One thinks everybody needs to hear this. And in fact, why not? Paramhansa Yogananda said, you should give away several copies of the autobiography of a yogi every week. You should just buy them by the case. And every time you find somebody who might be interested, you should give them one. He was not a shy man. You know, he went back and forth across the country and spoke about these teachings with tremendous energy, and he advertised what he was doing. I mean, he used all the medium of communication that's there. But to inform people about the possibility of something and then to try to persuade them by driving it down their throats, it's a lot of difference. So you invite, we invite, and we converse by introducing things slowly. I grew up in a family in which we never conversed, we only debated. It was a great liability in the work that I do, and it's taken me many years to overcome it. My brother, in fact, was actually, he was the state champion debater of the state of Texas 2 years in a row. And I am a chip off the old block, believe me. I mean, he was phenomenal. And so in our family, we never actually conversed. We just took turns presenting our best arguments. I thought that was conversation. You know, I mean, just literally, almost like with a timer. You would present your point of view and you would present it with as much force and persuasive energy as you possibly could. Then when you finally stopped, somebody else would present theirs. And it was like we were all, for us it was a system, it worked, you know, and then we'd all sort of look at the best arguments, and we were pretty honest, so we'd sort of figure out the best arguments. I didn't understand that conversation was other than that. I didn't understand that conversation was inviting people and then maybe listening and not immediately responding. Oh, what a novel idea. You know, and not dismantling what they said. I thought that's what you did. People speak and then you dismantle what they say, right? But isn't that a lot of how people interact as we try to make our point? Now, here's another aspect of it. Think how deeply secure one has to be in one's own reality in order to have no need for everyone else to agree with you. Think how deeply resting in the heart we have to be to allow people to just be themselves and not get all upset when they behave in ways that we don't particularly enjoy. I complained to Swamiji once about a certain person I had trouble getting along with because they were just so demanding in all respects. And Swamiji said, yes, essentially, a person doesn't give anyone else much room. He said, so when I'm with her, it was a woman in this case, he said, so when I'm with her, he said, I just don't bother to have a personality of my own. Wasn't that just a marvelous way to put it? I just don't bother to have a personality. If she wants to have all the personality in the room, that's fine. You know, I just won't have one. What freedom. You see what freedom in the heart that just says, you know, I could correct her. I could shine. She's not saying the right thing. That's my role. But instead just say, Om Swaha, what difference does it make? You know, if this works for her, if it would genuinely serve someone, and you feel that with perfect calmness when sometimes when people say, I have this thing I really feel I should tell so-and-so, I always say, how anxious are you to tell them? And if you're very, very anxious, it's usually a sign that you should at least wait a little while. Because when people hear you speak because you need to speak, you know, they always know it. Isn't that so? Especially your children. They always know it. They really feel it. But when you speak only and always because out of a sincere wish to help them, how different the whole exchange is. You know, this reading today takes it all the way to the question of spirituality. And what Swami is talking about is it's not helpful to tell a truth that someone isn't ready to hear. And all of this effort in the world for harmony and for people to get along, and it all springs from this fundamental deep desire to genuinely, sincerely have other people's interests at heart and have those interests be more important than your own. And we emphasize that every week in the Festival of Light in such a simple way. Pray too for the grace to share with all as you have received, for you are a part of all that is. But to share, for the grace not only to share, but for the ability to share with grace, with the divinely inspired. And then we will move ourselves to that beautiful inner world that we know is ours by right.